I seem to recall that we were in the middle of a survey of leukocytes. Slide 15. We didn't finish this, though, right? We aren't looking at all leukocytes here. We're looking at just one major subcategory. What were those? What are all these, I should say? They're all leukocytes, but all what subcategory of leukocytes? Yeah, these are all granulocytes, as opposed to agranulocytes, which are on the next slide. So we've already talked about why they're called neutrophils, eosinophils, and basophils based on their affinity for various dyes. Look at the percentages, though. Neutrophils are by far the most numerous of white blood cells in general, not just the most numerous granulocytes. They're the most numerous white blood cells, period. 60 to 70% of them, of course, they're vastly outnumbered by red blood cells, but 60 to 70% of however many white blood cells at any given moment are in the whole blood will be neutrophils. And look at what they do. Phagocytize bacteria and release antimicrobial chemicals. So these are all about killing bacteria that have invaded somehow. To phagocytize, of course, means to surround them and engulf them and kill them, but they also, these cells also release chemicals that are in various ways are deadly to bacteria. All right, then we have eosinophils, 2 to 4% of white blood cells in general, and they also phagocytize. They're phagocytic cells, but notice they primarily phagocytize antigen-antibody complexes. So when the antibodies that we were talking about in reference to blood types, when those other kinds of antibodies that are just part of the plasma that are there to recognize any sort of foreign antigen, particles that shouldn't be in your body, when those actually encounter something that that antibody is specific for, they'll bind. They recognize by binding, and that produces an antigen-antibody complex. That complex, then, is phagocytized by eosinophils. That's one of their major jobs. But they also phagocytize just allergens, antigens by themselves, and inflammatory chemicals. The second major function is that they are important in protecting you against eukaryotic invaders. Things like worms, not bacteria, but eukaryotic organisms. And then basophils, by far the least numerous of the white blood cells, less than 0.5% of white blood cells. These are important in the inflammatory response. And we'll talk more specifically about the inflammatory response in the immunity chapter. But inflammation is a way for the body to respond to some sort of trauma, and includes swelling and heat and redness and things like that. Well, there's many chemical changes that occur that bring about these various manifestations of inflammation, and partly because of the release of chemicals by basophils. Histamine is a chemical that's important in the inflammatory response, and it's a vasodilator, notice, so when basophils release this histamine, that causes local, meaning the just the blood vessels in the local area of whatever the trauma is, to increase their diameter, to vasodilate. This brings blood flow to the area so that other types of cells that are important for dealing with whatever the trauma is can get there soon, along with chemicals. They also, though, basophils, that is, secrete heparin, which is an anticoagulant. It keeps clotting from happening, and we'll be talking about clotting in a little bit in this chapter. But that's why some clinical instruments are said to be heparinized. They're coated with heparin so that if blood gets on them, the blood won't clot. All right, that's the granulocytes. Slide 16 shows you the agranulocytes, two major classes as you see here. But one of those A granulocyte classes is lymphocytes, and lymphocytes itself can be broken down further. Now, there are three major types that we'll deal with mostly in here, which are B lymphocytes, T lymphocytes, and natural killer cells. But even those can then be broken into subclasses. So there's many different kinds of lymphocytes, and they all basically look the same on a light microscope, but they have different jobs. Speaking of those several functions, though, they deal with cells that of your own that should not be there, that are defective in some way. Cancer cells, once they turn cancerous, can be recognized often and killed. So that's happening throughout your life. Cells go cancerous, but they are dealt with. It doesn't mean you have cancer. Cancer is when it gets out of control. But white blood cells can kill cancer cells when they arise spontaneously. But also cells that have been infected by viruses, plus foreign cells, are recognized by lymphocytes. Lymphocytes are very important in this immune response that has called specific immunity. There's different aspects to immunity, but specific immunity refers to the ability to recognize specific things that shouldn't be there rather than just a broad brush aspect, which is also part of immunity. But lymphocytes are there for specific immunity. Lymphocytes specifically are the type of white blood cells that produce the antibodies that we keep talking about. Some of these antibodies are, as they're secreted by the lymphocyte, become part of the plasma membrane. They're embedded in the plasma membrane, so you'll have a cell with antibodies sticking out of it. Other antibodies are totally secreted out of the cell and are no longer attached to a cell, and those are just free antibodies that are part of the plasma. They both operate, though, as antibodies, whether they're on a cell or not. There are certain chemicals that are released by lymphocytes that will recruit or enable other types of cells to do their jobs under the appropriate conditions, and they're really important in immune memory. The memory that we say the immune system has is really just a bank of different kinds of antibodies that are produced. As long as those antibodies are in circulation, antibodies of many, many different kinds, you only need a few of each type, because if something's in the bloodstream, eventually one of these will encounter it. Antibodies of the wrong type, you know, won't do anything, but eventually when the right type, which is randomly produced, just happens to find an antigen, that's when that particular kind of antibody will be multiplied, it will be replicated many, many times as a defense. So you just have a few in circulation that you made randomly. That's your memory, though. Now, antigen presentation is another important function of lymphocytes, and we'll talk more in detail in a different chapter on this. But what that refers to is when certain lymphocytes engulf a foreign material, which is an antigen, they will put that antigen or a part of that antigen's surface into the membrane facing exteriorly. So it presents that antigen to other cells so that they can recognize that it's something that should be dealt with. Okay, and then finally on the bottom, the other type of agranulocyte is a monocyte. And monocytes are big cells, as you can see in the picture here, compared to an erythrocyte. While they're in the blood, they're really not doing their job. But remember, white blood cells in general are fairly rare in the blood because they only spend a certain amount of time in there. Monocytes eventually leave the bloodstream and develop into macrophages, which are large phagocytic cells. They engulf various kinds of debris and invaders. Okay, so those are the leukocytes. Now, 17 shows you a developmental pathway for the various kinds of leukocytes. Now, this would actually you could actually include platelets and red blood cells on this as well. It just doesn't on this particular figure. The point here is that any kind of formed element, of which there are seven types, come from the same stem cells. Okay, what are the seven formed elements? Erythrocytes, platelets, and then the five leukocytes that we just talked about. Eosinophils, basophils, neutrophils, monocytes, and lymphocytes. Okay, so the only ones shown here, I mean, this is everything except the platelets and the red blood cells, but they, even those two come from this original cell as well, or can. So you have these stem cells in your marrow, and what type of stem cells are there? I mean, they're hematopoietic stem cells, that's what they're called. But functionally, how would you classify them? Right, they're pluripotent, not totipotent. So these are not cells that can become any type of cell in your body like an embryonic stem cell can. Instead, they can become any kind of the blood-formed elements. Well, anyway, in the formation of a leukocyte, you start out with a hematopoietic stem cell, but that then, when it splits, is going to form two cells, remember. One of those cells just stays behind, and it's now a hematopoietic stem cell itself. It replaces the one that no longer exists when the split occurs. The other one then goes on to one of these pathways, depending on how it's triggered. And whichever kind of leukocyte gets made eventually, there's a colony-forming unit that's first in line in this developmental sequence. So there's different kinds of colony-forming units corresponding to the different kinds of white blood cells. These then develop into blasts of some sort, or a blast, I should say, depending on which of these is chosen. It's not doing all of these, it's doing one of these, but it has the capability to do any of them. Anyway, there's myeloblasts in the case of three of these kinds of white blood cells. Myelo, by the way, is a... etymologically speaking, myelo means marrow. That's where these are, of course. Monoblasts just get their own name, but they're still a blast, and lymphoblasts get their own name. Blasts then develop into cytes, eventually. So we have eosinophilic myelocytes and so on, named for what they eventually will be in their mature version, which is shown on the right. Those are the ones that we have already talked about. Notice, by the way, on the pathway that leads to lymphocyte production, that the lymphoblast itself is a stem cell still, because it can develop into the any of the different subclasses of lymphocyte. And the three that I told you about already are shown here, but there's different subcategories within each of those. 18. Well, last time I was talking about looking at a blood smear on a slide, and I'm sure you've done this before in whatever course or just at your leisure with your scopes at home. But when you look at a typical blood smear, almost all the cells are red blood cells. And red blood cells are pretty nondescript because they are enucleate, right? They look like empty circles. They're biconcave discs, actually. Why do they, if they're biconcave discs, which are flattened, why do they all look round? Well, if I throw 100,000 pennies on the floor, chances are almost all of them, if not all of them, are going to land on the flat edge, right? Especially if I then sandwich a cover slip over that. So they're all lined up. In whole blood, they would be in all different directions, and that's why in that one picture you saw some of them on edge. But this is on a piece of glass, so they all fall onto their flat surface rather than lying on their edge. But they just look empty, basically, because you can't see the details. You can't see the hemoglobin molecules within them with just a normal light microscope. Every once in a while, though, here and there, you'll see one or another type of white blood cell, or maybe even platelets. Platelets, you can see there, are much smaller. They're by far the smallest formed element, and they're really the only reason we need the phrase formed element, right? Otherwise, we would just say blood cells. Platelets aren't true cells, but they start out as cells. And that's the point of what's coming next. In slide 19, we see how these platelets come to be. Well, at the top view is just a view of platelets. Now, this is very close up because these platelets are, like I just said, much smaller than red blood cells. So these look like they might be as big as a red blood cell. That's just because we're really in close on them, and because we don't have red blood cells or white blood cells to, right by them as for comparison. These are small bits. They're not true cells, just simply because they're not complete cells anymore. But they are made of membrane. They're covered, you know, they're just little sacs that bud off or get shorn off of a bigger cell that develops into them. So they don't have a nucleus, but they do have mitochondria, as you see. And they have a cytoskeleton within that, so they have microtubules and microfilaments. They also feature an open canalicular system, a system of tubes that extend to the surface, allowing them to secrete various things. In the bottom, we can see how this happens. So one of these big blobs at the top, that's one platelet shown here on the cartoon form on the bottom. And notice how small it is compared to the huge cell that it comes from. So in the development of platelets, you have, of course, the same stem cells as produce anything else, any other kind of formed element at first. And we've already talked about erythropoiesis being the subset of hemopoiesis that is just specifically production of red blood cells. You can also talk about leukopoiesis, production of any of the kinds of white blood cells. Productions of platelets has its own subset of hemopoiesis, which is thrombopoiesis. Now, thrombo, as a combining form, means clot. The word thrombus is another name for a clot. And platelets are involved in clotting, and therefore they're sometimes called thrombocytes, which is kind of a misnomer, because they're not true cells, and cell means site. I mean, site means cell. Anyway, thrombopoiesis simply refers to specifically the production of platelets versus any of the other formed elements. And when that hemopoietic stem cell gets stimulated into going the thrombopoiesis route rather than leuko or erythropoiesis, what will develop from that one stem cell is an enormous cell called a megakaryocyte. And the site, of course, means cell. What does the karyo mean? It does literally mean kernel, but in cell biology terms, the kernel of a cell is what? The nucleus. Karyo means nucleus, like in prokaryote and eukaryote. Mega means big, right? Well, this thing has a big nucleus, because what happens in the development of a megakaryocyte is that there will be many rounds of DNA replication, just like happens normally once in a normal cell, the typical cell, as part of mitosis, right? You have one replication round, then the nucleus splits, and then the cell, the cytoplasm splits, cytokinesis. Mitosis and cytokinesis produce two new cells, each one with a complete genome. Instead, what happens here is the DNA gets replicated many times without the nucleus actually dividing at all. And so you end up with not only a big cell, but a huge nucleus within this cell containing many, many different copies of DNA, which is why it's called a megakaryocyte. Now, this is in the marrow, where you would expect this to be for any kind of hemopoiesis. But in the red marrow are spaces, kind of blind-ended spaces that lead to blood vessels. And these spaces are called sinusoids. Now, sinus is a general word that means space. There are different kinds of sinuses in the body that use that word or a form. So a sinusoid is something that's literally like a sinus, not as big an opening as something that would be called a sinus, but it's a sinusoid, bigger than a normal blood vessel. In other words, it's a space in the marrow. And blood is flowing through these spaces. Well, the megakaryocyte will form pseudopods, just like an amoeba will. Only an amoeba is doing it for the purpose of locomotion, right? It's crawling from point A to point B by forming these pseudopodia. The pseudopodia that get produced by the megakaryocyte are just projections of the cell into these sinusoids through tiny spaces in the wall of the sinusoid. But the pseudopod itself extends into the lumen of the sinusoid where the blood is. And that blood flow, the current of that blood flow, will shear off pieces of it. Pieces of the pseudopodia. And these little pieces are the platelets. So a single megakaryocyte can make many, many platelets. And by the way, platelets, in terms of number, platelets are the second most numerous formed element, second only to erythrocytes. So I think I said before that a good average is that a cubic micrometer, which is a microliter of blood. I'm sorry, a cubic millimeter, which is a microliter of blood, just 1 millimeter by 1 millimeter by 1 millimeter cube, contains about 5 million red blood cells. Well, it also contains about 500,000 platelets, whereas it's very, there aren't very many white blood cells in there at all of any type. So platelets are the second most numerous, but because they're so much smaller than any of the true cells, they combine for not very much volume. When you look at the buffy coat, the platelets are the thinnest part of that buffy coat. So they don't even though they're the second most numerous formed element, they don't even form as much volume as the white blood cells. Okay, so that's how we form platelets. Let's look at how they work. This is slide 20 now. Remember what I said the word is that refers to the stoppage of bleeding? Well, the question isn't, do you remember? The question is, what is that word? That's not the word I want. That's the formation of a clot, which is not the only way bleeding is stopped. The more general term that refers to, in general, the stoppage of bleeding. I'm looking for the name of a process. The process is hemostasis, or if you prefer, hemostasis. Remember I said that's why hemostats are called that? They stop bleeding. So what we're seeing in slide 20 are the three ways, or the three aspects of hemostasis, or stoppage of blood, of bleeding. Now, we all know when we injure ourselves to the point of bleeding, when we see blood, we know that we've damaged ourselves to the point of bleeding. But actually, we're damaging the very small vessels all the time without it actually blood coming through our skin, without actually trauma to the skin. We're rupturing vessels. So there's internally there's damage that's done all the time because the tubes are so small. They just normal living, normal moving around can cause bleeding, internal bleeding. Now I'm talking about not internal bleeding that you need to go to the hospital for. I'm just talking about tiny, tiny amounts of internal bleeding, but it still has to be dealt with. But of course, it also applies to bigger trauma, like when you cut yourself somehow. Well, these three aspects are shown in from left to right, not only in order in which they occur, but also in the order in increasing order of effectiveness. All right. The first is vascular spasm, as you see here. And platelets are involved. Well, I should say platelets are involved in all three of these. But platelets are involved in vascular spasm because they can release chemicals. Okay? Vasoconstrictive chemicals. Now, when an injury occurs, well, let me say before the injury occurs, platelets are always there in the blood. They're circulating along with the other formed elements. But platelets don't stick to a healthy internal surface or endothelium of a vessel. Right? A normal endothelium is a smooth surface that these platelets do not stick to. But when an injury occurs, there's a tear somewhere in the vessel. So at that little point, these platelets are now exposed to connective tissue that they're not usually exposed to. The endothelium, the lining that's made by the cells that make up the wall of the internal wall of the vessel, that's epithelial tissue, right? When there's a rip in that, the stuff that's immediately superficial to that, meaning away from the lumen, is connective tissue, fibrous tissue. And that fibrous tissue is rough stuff that these platelets can actually stick to. Well, that doesn't actually happen until platelet plug formation. But when there is a tear in the endothelium, there's release of signals in a couple ways. The surrounding tissue, the non-blood vessel tissue, if it gets injured, usually there are nerve endings in there acting as nociceptors. Remember what nociceptors are? Pain receptors, right. These pain receptors, of course, are important for sending information to your brain so that you feel this in an unpleasant way. But also these nociceptors innervate nearby tissue, including nearby capillaries. So signals are sent nervously to cells for them to cause vasoconstriction in this area. Vasoconstriction is the first line of defense, in other words. That's why this is called vascular spasm. Spasm tells you that this is a temporary thing, right? You wouldn't want to permanently vasoconstrict a vessel because otherwise it can't do its job. Its normal job is to get blood running through it. But if there is a leak, you want to shut down blood flow through it temporarily. And that's what vascular spasm is. It's temporary vasoconstriction in response to the surrounding tissue and the endothelial tissue of the vessel itself being done. And platelets help out in this because they also release their own vasoconstrictive chemicals in response to the injury. Just the ones in the area, of course. All right. This is simply to minimize the blood loss. Vascular spasm, it's vasoconstriction, doesn't really heal the hole, it just makes it less likely for blood to come out because it clamps down the diameter of the vessel. But it doesn't form a plug. Platelet plug formation comes next, and it doesn't take long after the vascular spasm for this to take place. It's self-explanatory. A bunch of platelets in that area start sticking to not only the connective tissue that gets exposed because of the injury, because of the tear in the endothelial lining of the vessel, but once they stick to that, then they start sticking to each other as well, the platelets. And so an increasing mass of platelets forms, all stuck together. That is the platelet plug. They not only stick to each other, but they start to pull away from each other. When they're all connected, though, and they try to pull away from each other, what happens is that the entire mass gets smaller and more condensed, forms a tighter plug, in other words. Okay? So that doesn't take very long to get put into place at all, but it's not all that great a plug, because platelets are fairly still, compared to a clot, platelets are fairly loosely arranged. They don't do the job that a clot will do. And clotting, which is called coagulation, is the final step of hemostasis. Now, clot formation or coagulation is chemically very complex. There's a lot of steps to it. But what happens is that after this platelet plug formation occurs, the platelet plug is already in place, a component of the plasma is used to form a clot. And I already told you what that component of the plasma is. What is that? Fibrinogen, correct. Fibrinogen is in your blood all the time. It's circulating around as plasma, or as a plasma protein, I should say. Remember, the plasminogen is the stuff that if you remove that and you remove the cells, what you have left over is serum, right? That's the difference between plasma and serum. Plasma doesn't have the cells, but it does have the plasminogen. Serum doesn't have the cells or the plasminogen. Anyway, this plasminogen is circulating with your blood all the time, doing nothing. Importantly, because you don't want a clot to form unless you need a clot, right? That can cause a lot of problems. So, once the platelet plug is formed, there's all kinds of signals that give rise to the formation of this clot made out of fibrin, which is a protein. But fibrin isn't normally present in your plasma. It's fibrinogen that gets its name from the fact that fibrinogen can be converted into fibrin. That produces many, many individual fibrin monomers, which then can be linked together to form a huge polymer of fibrin that we call a clot or a thrombus. All right, and that does a much, well, the clot forms, and that's a much stronger plug than the platelet plug to begin with. And now it's not pure fibrin. I should have specified that this fibrin forms, but the clot is made out of fibrin as a mesh, which does a good job of collecting more and more platelets and other debris. And these platelets now continue their job of pulling on each other, which means that as a clot matures, after it already exists and it gets older, it will get smaller and smaller and squeeze out the liquid that's in there and become more and more solid. All right, so it makes a really good good stopper to whatever hole is in the vessel, but this, of course, has to be a temporary device, right? You don't want this to be there permanently. So this is another important job of platelets. After the clot has done its job and it's time to remove it, well, I should say during this time the clot is in there, platelets release other chemicals that called platelet-derived growth factors that spur on mitosis and cytokinesis in nearby connective tissue cells. In other words, platelets tell the surrounding area, the cells in the surrounding area, to get busy reproducing themselves to create the cells necessary to replace the ones that are lost by the injury. So while the clot is in place, the thing is healing as well. I said before that the coagulation pathway is chemically very complex. This is a complex enough slide, but this is just a condensed version. There's many different factors, clotting factors involved. We can call them either clotting factors, or another name for them is procoagulants, as opposed to anticoagulants, which would do the opposite job. Procoagulants are doing their job of promoting clot formation. But these factors, which mostly have Roman numerals on them, these are different kinds of proteins. And most of them are acting as enzymes, functionally speaking. Okay, which is not surprising for proteins. But what we have here is kind of a two-pronged attack to making a clot. You see at the top that there is the so-called extrinsic mechanism and the intrinsic mechanism to clot formation. So this isn't part of platelet plug formation, this is after. Extrinsic means occurring outside of. Intrinsic means occurring inside of. What that specifically means in terms of clot formation is that the extrinsic mechanism uses or is initiated by things other than the blood, cells outside of the blood, non-blood cells, in other words, whereas the intrinsic mechanism involves the blood itself. And notice the convergence here. The intrinsic pathway and the extrinsic pathway meet at a common point here. This node, which is just halfway through the process, either one of them, in other words, either extrinsic or intrinsic mechanism, can lead to this common part and eventually go all the way through to the clot formation. So what happens when an injury occurs is that both mechanisms, intrinsic and extrinsic, are invoked simultaneously, but they eventually end up doing the same thing once you get to the part where that's common to both of them, the common pathway on the bottom. All right, so in the extrinsic mechanism, notice that what you have here is production of thromboplastin, which, I don't really want to name all these things to you because that's going to imply that I want you to know the name of all these ones. And I don't, most of them are just called factor, some number. But like I said, most of them are operating as enzymes. So you have inactivated enzymes already present in the blood, which are, these are various kinds of plasma proteins. But they're in the inactive form, so they don't work as an enzyme in the inactive form. If they are activated, then they will do their job of, which is the general job of an enzyme, which is to convert something into something else, right? So without an injury, they're just doing nothing. They're circulating as plasma proteins. When they get the signal, when an injury occurs, the original signal converts a first enzyme into an active form. Its job then is to convert another enzyme from inactive to active form, and so on through many stages Another confusing thing about this is that these Roman numerals have no correlation to when these things operate. They're named just for the order in which they were discovered, which is just randomly, of course, right? So it's not that Roman numeral 1 works first to convert factor 2 and so on. It's they're all over the place simply because they're named for their order of discovery. But notice that there's an inactive form being turned into an active form by a preceding factor in the pathway. And so you finally get to the common point, and the same thing is still happening. Inactive forms are getting turned into active forms, and eventually you get down to one that is worth remembering the name of, prothrombin, which is named that because it's not the active form yet. It's before thrombin, literally. It gets converted into thrombin. Thrombin is the active form. All right. And thrombin's job, once it is finally activated, after all these steps, its job is, once again, to convert something into something else. So it is an enzyme. But it is the specific enzyme that converts fibrinogen, which is the stuff we've been talking about, into fibrin. And once you have fibrin, it is the stuff that actually produces the clot. Fibrin is much less soluble than fibrinogen, which is why fibrinogen is just in the plasma circulating all the time, doing nothing if there's no injury. But when it gets converted into fibrin, that fibrin comes out of solution. It's not soluble really at all. And thrombin will produce individual fibrin monomers, which are like little strands, one at a time. You know, each fibrinogen can be converted into one fibrin strand. You do that over and over, you have a bunch of fibrin strands which can be hooked end to end to produce longer strands. And then those longer strands can actually be linked side by side to make a mesh. That's requires yet another factor. After thrombin has done its job, then the fibrins that are produced get assembled into a fibrin polymer. That fibrin polymer is kind of like a web, a spider's web, which is easily able to catch things that are coming through it, including debris and platelets and proteins of other sorts. Those all contribute to the clot. And then the clot will get smaller as these platelets pull on each other. Well, this is an example of a positive feedback mechanism, because once this pathway is first invoked, it will tell itself to be invoked again, and more thrombin gets activated to produce more and more fibrin. But the body has to be very careful that this is happening just locally, because a positive feedback mechanism could get out of hand quickly, right? And your entire bloodstream could clot, which would kill you. So it has to be a positive feedback mechanism with a lot of control so that it does not get out of hand. And it's occurring really only where there is a breakage in that endothelial lining. When you have a nice intact vascular endothelium, the clotting is kept from happening. Okay, 22. This actually summarizes just the extrinsic pathway, but you could make a similar slide for the intrinsic pathway. Actually, you see extrinsic just for the top part, and then the bottom part is the common pathway. But anyway, the important point here is that we have a cascade. Yes, it's really complicated to use all of these different enzymes, but why do we? What's the goodness of having all of these steps? What is the benefit of a cascade, in other words? Amplification. When you're bleeding, you don't say, well, one day I might put a plug in that hole. Right? You want to get to it immediately. So by having all these things in place, but in the inactive form, and each step causing several of the next step, just like we talked about for hormones, you can immediately form millions of fibrins in response to just one original signal at the top, one of the factor 12s. Meanwhile, a bunch of other factor 12s are producing millions of their own after the amplification steps. So it's a way to get a clot built very quickly, much quicker than you would if you had to build all that stuff to begin with. You don't produce the proteins in response to the injury. You just convert the proteins into active form. What is it that produces the proteins to begin with? Except for fibrinogen. The liver, right. The liver produces the vast majority of plasma proteins in general, not just these clotting factors. Which I think is the ultimate slide. Here we're looking at the removal of the clot. Remember, the clot can't stay there. Once it's done its job and through the action of growth factors released by platelets, the surrounding tissue has healed, and you once again have an intact endothelium on the vessel, it's time to get rid of the clot, which means that that polymer that it's largely made of needs to be degraded, broken down, digested, in essence. Well, there's another positive feedback loop that's used here, but what's happening here is similar to what happens in clotting. It's just performing the opposite action. Prekallikrein, that's the inactive form, so that's a protein that gets converted by factor 12 into kallikrein. Okay? By the way, the clotting factors I already told you were called procoagulants. The factors that are involved in dissolving a clot are called anticoagulants. And so kallikrein, once it gets into its active form, acts as an enzyme whose job it is to convert plasminogen into plasmin. So instead of, this is very similar to thrombin doing its job of converting fibrinogen into fibrin. That's when you want to make a clot. Here you need to convert plasminogen into plasmin so that it can do its job of breaking that clot apart, breaking it down into the individual subunits. So the fibrin polymer gets dissolved or gets digested by plasmin, but plasmin's not going to be there until the clot has run its course, it's done its job. That's when kallikrein gets activated so that plasmin can be produced out of plasminogen. And once you have the degradation products, they are just reused like organic molecules are in general, right? They're mostly amino acids, which are useful for building other proteins. But notice the positive feedback loop. Plasmin itself, you activate a little plasminogen into plasmin, it not only does its job of breaking the clot apart, but plasmin feeds back in the pathway and activates even more kallikrein, which makes even more plasmin, so it keeps building. So you build a clot fairly quickly compared to how you would have to do it if you started from scratch, and you also get rid of that clot fairly quickly. And that's pretty good timing.